Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're plunging into a fascinating and sometimes perplexing issue for anyone who believes in God, particularly within Christianity. The concept of divine hiddenness, this idea, brought to the forefront in recent decades by the scholar Schellenberg, essentially asks, if God is real and wants us to know it, well, why isn't his existence obvious to everyone?
It's a really fundamental question, isn't it? For some, like our source material points out, it feels connected to the problem of evil, why a good God would allow suffering.
Right.
But others, like the philosopher Peter van Inwagen, see it more as an epistemological puzzle, why the lack of clear, undeniable evidence.
Yeah, exactly. And Van Inwagen actually gives you a pretty concise summary of the problem. Okay, let's unpack this a bit. He argues that, well, if God exists, knowing that would be incredibly important for humans.
Crucial, yeah.
And if God exists, surely he'd have the power to provide clear signs. So logically, if God exists, he would provide clear signs.
Makes sense.
But the crucial point is, Van Inwagen says, we just don't see these unmistakable, universally accepted signs.
Right, nothing undeniable for everyone.
Therefore, it gives us reason to, well, doubt God's existence. Pretty stark stuff.
It is. And what's fascinating here is Van Inwagen's insistence that this problem of divine hiddenness isn't just a side effect of a world filled with hardship. He posits that even in a hypothetical world devoid of moral evil and suffering, like no crime, no illness, no physical pain, the question of God's apparent absence could still arise.
Even in a perfect world.
Yeah, people might still wonder, about their origins, about the nature of reality, and some might remain unconvinced of God's existence. So even if your life was perfect, free from pain and suffering, Van Inwagen is saying that the intellectual puzzle, the lack of clear divine evidence, would still remain a valid reason for doubt.
Exactly. So in that kind of, let's say, utopian scenario, the lack of obvious divine presence becomes purely an issue of knowledge, or as Van Inwagen puts it, a purely epistemological problem, completely separate from the problem of evil. Which leads us to the core question we're diving into today. How do we reconcile this apparent hiddenness of God with the deeply held belief that God actually wants people to know him?
It's the central tension, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Van Inwagen himself offers an interesting starting point. He firmly believes that God does care deeply about how and why people come to believe in him. It's not just about intellectual assent for God, according to Van Inwagen.
Precisely. He contrasts the idea of ubiquitous miracles, think constant messages in the sky, undeniable divine interventions happening all the time.
Like divine skywriting.
Huh, yeah, exactly. With God's deeper interest in something far more profound, significant personal transformation. And here's where it gets really interesting. Van Inwagen suggests that God's very hiddenness actually plays a role in making these transformations more meaningful.
How so?
Well, if God were constantly and obviously intervening, your belief might just be a knee-jerk reaction to overwhelming evidence, not a genuine heartfelt change.
That makes a lot of sense when you think about it, doesn't it? If God's presence were as obvious as the sun in the sky, would your belief truly be a matter of faith? Or just, acknowledging an undeniable fact? Van Inwagen seems to be suggesting that the element of seeking, the wrestling with questions, the personal journey towards belief, that's crucial for the kind of transformation God desires.
Right. Now, moving on, another perspective comes from the scholar Michael Murray. He brings the concept of free will into the conversation. He applies a free will theodicy, the idea that God allows evil to preserve free will specifically to this problem of divine hiddenness.
So Murray argues that for you to freely choose God, to embrace faith and obedience, certain conditions must be in place. And maybe more importantly, certain conditions must not be in place.
Like what?
Well, the big one here is the absence of compulsion, especially compulsion arising from a significant threat. If you feel forced to believe because the alternative is, well, terrifyingly clear, is that really a free choice?
That's a powerful point to consider. And Murray then delves into what makes a threat significant. He breaks it down. First, there's threat strength, how harmful you perceive the consequences to be. And as our source points out, eternal damnation is about as strong a threat as you can imagine.
Ultimate threat strength.
Right.
Then he discusses threat imminence, which is your expectation of when those consequences will follow. And Murray breaks this down further into three subcategories. There's probabilistic imminence, how likely you think the consequences are. Scripture, he notes, often suggests the certainty of hell for the wicked. Then there's temporal imminence, how soon you expect those consequences. The fact that judgment isn't immediate, that offers some mitigation there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Bit of breathing room.
Okay, makes sense. And the third one.
And finally, the crucial one for Murray's argument. Epistemic threat imminence. This is all about how clear and unambiguous the threat is.
Ah, clear.
Exactly. If the threat of hell is presented with absolute certainty and overwhelming evidence, it becomes a much stronger source of potential compulsion. The clearer and more undeniable the threat, the less room for genuine free choice, according to Murray.
Right.
He also considers the wantonness of the threatened, basically, how much a person disregards their own well-being. If someone genuinely doesn't care about their ultimate fate, the threat won't be as compelling for them.
But God wouldn't want us to be like that, presumably.
Probably not. Murray argues that God likely wouldn't eliminate this concern for well-being, as it's generally a good thing. So what Murray's doing here is dissecting how different aspects of a threat, how bad it is, how likely, how clearly presented, impact your sense of free choice regarding God.
So Murray concludes that the degree of compulsion you feel is directly linked to the threat's strength and imminence,
mm-hmm.
and inversely linked to your wantonness, your disregard for yourself.
Yeah.
Given the undeniable strength of the threat of eternal damnation and that God wouldn't want you apathetic. Murray suggests God mitigates the threat primarily by reducing its epistemic imminence. Reducing the clarity.
Exactly. And what's fascinating here is how this connects directly to divine hiddenness. Murray's argument is that God's relative hiddenness, the lack of absolute, irrefutable proof of his existence and the nature of hell, makes the threat of punishment less clear and unambiguous.
So the ambiguity is deliberate.
Yes. This reduced epistemic imminence, in turn, lessens the feeling of compulsion, preserving your free choice to either obey or disobey God.
It's a clever way of looking at it. The ambiguity isn't a flaw, but a feature designed to protect free will. And it's interesting, our source even quotes Isaiah, "Surely you are a God who hides himself," suggesting the premise of God's hiddenness has scriptural roots.
It does add a layer of scriptural plausibility, yeah.
Yeah.
However, this perspective isn't without its critics. Philosopher Lovering offers a strong counterargument. He suggests that Murray's approach ultimately fails and could even lead to the conclusion that God doesn't exist.
Wow. Okay. Let's unpack Lovering's critique then. He summarizes Murray's argument as essentially saying, we need to develop morally significant characters.
Mm-hmm.
And if God weren't hidden, we'd be compelled to believe and act rightly, which would hinder that moral development. Therefore, God must be hidden for moral growth.
And Lovering identifies some key meta-ethical assumptions underlying Murray's argument. Firstly, the idea that there's a strong link between morality and God's commands.
Okay.
And secondly, that the moral status of your actions isn't determined by what you humans happen to believe. Morality is objective in this view.
Right. But here's Lovering's central point of contention. While he agrees that being coerced would prevent genuine moral development.
Yeah, forced morality isn't real morality.
Exactly. But he argues that coercion isn't the only obstacle. He introduces the concept of inculpable ignorance of the moral status of actions.
Inculpable ignorance.
Yeah.
Meaning you're not blameworthy for not knowing.
Precisely. If you're not blameworthy for not knowing what's right and wrong, then Lovering argues you can't truly develop morally.
That's a crucial distinction. Lovering argues that intending to do good requires actually knowing what good is.
Makes sense.
And his concern with Murray's framework is that if God is too hidden, some people will justifiably give up on belief altogether. They'll become, in his words, inculpably ignorant of the good.
So, like, moral nihilists.
Essentially, yes. People who don't believe in any objective moral truths because the source of those truths, God, is too hidden for them to reasonably believe in. See, this is where it gets really naughty, isn't it? Lovering is saying Murray's solution might create a whole new problem.
So Lovering's argument is that while divine hiddenness might reduce compulsion, it simultaneously undermines your ability to even intend to do good because you lack a clear understanding of what good is. It takes away with one hand what it gives with the other.
Exactly. Lovering concludes that whether God is hidden or not, you can't develop morally significant characters under Murray's framework. If God is hidden, you risk inculpable moral ignorance.
Right.
If God isn't hidden, you face compulsion. This leads to a contradiction with the initial premise that you can develop morally significant characters.
Because under either scenario, you can't.
Right. And therefore, Lovering argues, this points towards God not existing. It's a powerful and challenging critique.
It certainly is. It raises that fundamental question. How can God ensure, you know, the moral good without making his presence so overwhelming that it eliminates your free will? It seems like a real catch-22.
But our source introduces a compelling response to Levering's critique, focusing on the concept of natural law.
Ah, natural law. The idea that there's a fundamental understanding of right and wrong ingrained in human nature.
Exactly. Almost like a universal moral code we're all born with to some extent.
So even without explicit divine revelation, people have a fundamental grasp of concepts like justice, fairness, the difference between right and wrong, an innate moral compass.
Precisely. And this innate moral awareness, according to this line of thought, addresses Levering's concern about inculpable ignorance.
Yes.
Well, even if someone doesn't believe in God, they still possess a foundational understanding of morality built into their very being.
Our source mentions Levering briefly considers and dismisses a version of natural law based on observing divine order in nature.
Right, but the key point here, presented by Spiegel in our source, is the alternative, that God has built this moral understanding directly into your cognitive structure, your conscience, what some might call the law of God written on the heart.
So it's internal, not external observation.
Exactly. And Spiegel believes Levering overlooks this. This innate moral awareness provides a basis for understanding good and bad, even in the absence of a clear, obvious divine presence.
Mm-hmm.
So even if God is somewhat hidden, you're not necessarily left in a state of complete moral ignorance. You still have that internal guide.
Okay. So to recap our deep dive today, we've explored Van Inwagen's framing of divine hiddenness as a potential reason for doubt, separate from the problem of evil.
Mm-hmm.
Then we looked at Murray's free will defense hiddenness, reducing epistemic immanence to preserve freedom.
Right, the clarity issue.
But Levering challenged this, arguing hiddenness leads to moral ignorance, potentially undermining moral development, and even arguing against God's existence.
A significant challenge.
And finally, we considered Spiegel's response, highlighting natural law and innate moral understanding as a way God could provide moral guidance even while remaining relatively hidden.
And when we connect this to the bigger picture, what's fascinating is this delicate balance being explored. The tension between God's presumed desire for humanity to know him,
mm-hmm.
and the need to preserve genuine human freedom and moral agency. How can both be achieved? It's complex.
It leaves us with a final thought for you, the listener. How does this idea of an innate moral compass shape your own understanding of divine hiddenness and your responsibility, perhaps, to seek truth and meaning? Consider how these different viewpoints, the need for clear signs, the importance of free choice versus compulsion, the risk of moral ignorance, the possibility of inherent moral understanding, how might they impact your own perspective on faith, doubt, and the very nature of morality in a world where God isn't always, you know, shouting from the rooftops?
It's certainly something to continue pondering. A lot to chew on there.